talk of the last session for today is Knowledge Sharing and Social Networks by Lotta Adamek.
Okay, thanks. All right, so what I wanted to talk about is actually some primarily joint work with Mark Ackerman and a bunch of students at the School of Information at the University of Michigan. And this is about knowledge sharing rather than say, sharing other undesirable things such as, say, disease. So what we've been focusing on has been all of these knowledge generation websites and tools that people are employing now in order to suss out the best information, create the best summaries, and even solve each other's problems all online. So one of my favorite examples are actually recipe sites, where not only can you rate recipes and so find good recipes, but also others will suggest improvements. So, you know, here's the healthy version or here's the slightly more flavorful version. So as Nathan mentioned, a lot of these social interactions are much more easily studied because they're mediated by the web. Essentially, we have a convergence of social and information networks. And, of course, one of the things that we focus on is really the diversity and the number of contacts that people have. So in social networks, it's really nice to be a hub, but it kind of depends on what you're sharing, right? So if you're catching a cold, people might not be so fond of being exposed to you. One network that we studied was that of product recommendations, specifically an online retailer that sells books, among other products, had this incentivized system. So they wanted to take advantage of potentially viral marketing where they let their customers do the product promotion for them. So what happens is Bob will purchase a book, and at the point of purchase, he can recommend that book to his friend Alice. And if Alice buys it, she'll get 10% off, and he'll get a 10% credit towards his next purchase. They'll both be happy, right? So this is the idea, and then she can recommend forward. And what we wanted to know is how can we map the influence of individuals on one another when it comes to product purchases. Here is a network for a particular book. This is a medical study guide. And each edge represents a recommendation, and the red edges are the ones where the recommendation was actually successful. So the first person bought, they sent a recommendation to the second person, and that person bought as well. So there are several different questions that we can ask. The first is, you know, are hubs really that important? If you send out 100 recommendations, are you going to influence 100 times as many people as, or say 10 times as many people as someone who sends out just 10? And it turns out to not be the case, right? This isn't like sending an email virus. It's actually influencing someone not just to shell out the cash to buy the book, but also probably to intend to read it, which is an investment in time. So what you see actually is that past a couple of dozen recommendations, your influence tends to level off, right? So you can't really, on average, influence that many people to purchase things you want them to purchase. The second question may be, well, what happens if multiple of your contacts are recommending the same product to you? And so what this is showing is what happens when you receive the first recommendation. And here, I mean, this is rather dismal, right? So this is a book, and you have a 1% chance of buying the book if you receive that recommendation, right? If you still haven't purchased the book, but you receive a separate recommendation from another one of your contacts, this probability actually doubles. And thereafter, you're still not buying the book, and each subsequent recommendation might further influence you a little bit, but, you know, it tends to fall off, right? The final thing is whether you can assume that this is a static network that retailers can take advantage of. So what this is showing is for two individuals who have exchanged multiple recommendations, how likely that second individual is to follow the recommendation the first, second, third time, etc. So what you can see here is that for the first three recommendations, you have about equal probability of making that purchase. You're thinking, well, Lotta recommended this book to me, so it's probably okay, you know, I might buy it. After a while, though, you might start to suspect that what I'm doing is really trying to get discounts for myself and I'm not really giving you good recommendations. And actually, the tie itself is weakened, right? I just seem less credible in my influence over you. Another thing that we looked at was what kinds of products are more likely to be accepted following a recommendation. And on the left, I'm showing products that didn't have much success and products that did. So things that were not recommended easily were just the bestsellers, the kind of pulp fiction. Similarly, books on spirituality and New Age religion, and tomato growing. So tomato growing. So I grow tomatoes, right? But I'm not very social about it. I don't go to tomato growing conventions or, you know, talk to that many others. On the other hand, I don't know if you've ever been to an orchid growing convention. I have. And those people are very, very social about their activity, from the conventions to the websites where they share all that they know, right? And so books on orchids are much more successfully recommended. Similarly, books relating to organized religion, if I tell you, hey, here's a book on how to be a good Christian, right? You might be more likely to follow that recommendation if we're both in the same church, for example. Or if we're both medical students and I'm recommending a book to you, because this is a smaller subset and also because those things are really expensive, you may be more inclined to accept my recommendation and try to get that discount. Okay, and finally, one overall trend that we saw is that these product recommendations are most successful in the long tail. So they're not so much the bestsellers, the Harry Potter books, or, you know, even though those sell a lot of copies, the recommendations, what they're really doing is they're boosting the long tail. So books that have a few people making the recommendations, few people receiving the recommendations, but actually kind of a dense network of recommendations between them, are the ones where the recommendations are most likely to be successful. So that was a viral marketing study. What I'd like to talk about now is some more recent work, not so much about sharing, you know, what products should you buy, but people actively seeking advice, not just on products, but pretty much any question they have, from why is the sky blue, to can someone debug my code, I can't get it to work, to you know, even wanting to prompt some discussions, for example, asking, you know, have the conservatives been good for the U.S. over the past few years, something like that. And we've studied a whole bunch of these online question answer forums and wanted to employ network analysis in order to figure out who the experts are and what is the overall dynamic. So there's a lot of related work, so just to put this in context, because the data online is so rich, you have sociologists looking at the different roles that people assume in online question answer forums. You also have psychologists trying to figure out what are the motivations for participation. Also, how likely is a person to remain active in a community, given that, for example, their first post used words such as, you know, you, which tended to mean that they wouldn't get a reply and they wouldn't remain in the community, versus someone who would use words such as I, explaining what their situation is and what their interests are. There has also been a lot of work from the computer science area, namely trying to do text mining to identify the experts, and also using network-based algorithms, just as I'll describe shortly, we did, to try and identify them as well. So the first study we did was of an online programming forum, Everything About Java. And within this forum, what we did is we looked at people asking and people replying, and whenever there was an asker and a replier, we would draw a directed edge actually from the asker to the replier, indicating that the person who had replied was probably more expert than they were themselves. And if you construct, this is just a tiny fragment of such a network, you can see that there are these very highly active nodes. They're mostly repliers. They'll answer everyone's questions. And then there are some people in the middle who actually get a lot of replies, but that distribution is nowhere near as skewed. And what we wanted to know is, does this network topology actually tell us who the experts are in this network? So an expert could be just someone who is very active and replies a lot. They could be someone who helps a lot of people, not just helps a few people a lot. They could be someone who answers more often than they ask. They could be someone who helps people or replies to people who themselves are helping others. And for this, we use the notion of PageRank, so just propagating these expertise scores. Or you could be using the HITS algorithm, also an algorithm to identify important nodes in networks. This would imply that there's a subset of users who ask the good questions and the good answers focus on them. And so there would be kind of a reinforcement between those two groups. So in order to figure out whether our automated methods worked, we actually used some human raters who read through the replies of some of these Java Forum users and rated the actual repliers from complete newbie to, you know, top-level Java expert could actually, you know, hack the core libraries. And what we found was actually that all of our algorithms seemed to work, which was, great, right? The experts were really easy to identify. It was that the people who replied most were also the most expert, according to our human raters. Possibly the best predictors were actually that they replied more than they asked. But this is where modeling comes in. We weren't quite happy with this. We didn't know what the underlying dynamic was that was causing our algorithms to work so well. So we built, this is actually work by Jun Zhang. He built an agent-based simulation where you have each one of these nodes is a participant in the network, and all that they start out with is some expertise level. And you assign an expertise, you have some expertise distribution. Usually it's that you have a whole lot of newbies, and as you get more in expertise, more advanced expertise, you have fewer and fewer of people at that level of expertise. Now the interesting part comes in when you choose a rule for who's going to answer any given question. So on the left is the best preferred scenario. What this says is that most of the questions are going to be posed by newbies, and the people who are most likely to answer are the ones whose expertise is highest above that of the person who's asking, right? So the difference is the greatest. So what ends up happening is that most of the questions are actually answered by the top-level experts. Another scenario, which seems quite plausible, is that that everyone's kind of more conservative about their time, and they're only going to choose to answer those questions which are just below their level of expertise, right? They're going to find these questions challenging, and they're going to leave the easy stuff to others, right? It's not essential for them to answer it. And if you look at the networks, this produces two rather different topologies. You get my mouse? Okay. So with the best preferred, you have the high-level experts denoted by the larger nodes in the center of the network, and the less expert nodes move to the periphery. And you can see this as well in this, where the nodes are sorted by expertise, so you have the high-level experts pretty much replying to everyone else. On the other hand, if you have this sorting by expertise, it's always the next-level experts who are replying to the ones just below them. And this actually pushes the most expert users to the periphery of the network. So now we've simulated these two networks, and we can look at the empirical characteristics of our Java Forum network and see which one matches. So on the top, you have the real Java Forum, and what this is showing is how many others has the helper helped before, and how many others has the asker helped before. And there's some correlation, typically, that the helper has usually helped a lot of other people, and maybe there's a little bit of a diagonal correlation going on with people matching expertise. But you can see that actually the best preferred model looks a lot more like the empirically observed than the just better. And this is nice because we can then explain why these algorithms work like they do. In the best preferred model, it turns out that simple things like degree, how many people you've helped, is actually the best predictor of how expert you are, right? And if it was the just better scenario, we actually find that PageRank would do better, right? Because there's some people are sorting according to expertise, and so you have the highest level experts helping the guys in the middle who are helping the complete newbies. So not only can we explain the topology that we observe, but we can also infer how well algorithms would work for scenarios that seem plausible, but we just have not really seen yet. And if I have time, I'll kind of explain why why you get people actually answering everyone's questions. So we wanted to look at a slightly broader forum, actually a really broad forum, Yahoo Answers, where people answer not just programming questions, but they give advice about marriage, they give support and factual advice about topics such as cancer. And we wanted to know, well, what happens to the quality of the answers that one individual provides compared to their entropy, right? And in this case, it's not entropy of where they go in physical space, but entropy of where they go within the online forum. And so one question may be, if you have someone who's really good at answering questions about car maintenance and repairs, are they going to also be really great at giving hair advice, or maybe not? So here's a user with zero entropy. All she'll answer are questions about dogs. And here's a user with very high entropy, and he's actually willing to answer questions about both singles and dating and infectious diseases. So he might be might be a good subject to study. So when we look at the proportion of best answers that users give, and the best answer is actually selected by the asker, which is problematic in and of itself because, you know, yesterday this person didn't know what the answer was, and today they're picking what the best answer was. However, we find that in different types of categories, being focused matters more or less. So in the kind of tech... What's my time? No, you weren't? Okay. In the technical kind of factual categories, computers and internet, math and science, it actually correlates quite highly that, for example, you're only answering questions about biology and not biology, chemistry, physics, astronomy. For other things, for example, giving family and relationships advice or even sports are typically discussions about which team's going to win tomorrow, it really doesn't, it's not a very good predictor at all, right? So we have this result that people have some knowledge, and for some types of knowledge, it's actually better to focus a bit. There's also this differentiation between the categories, as you might imagine. In precisely those categories where focus is good, you have that the askers are typically not the repliers, right? In other categories where it's not as important, you have people taking on both roles, and this you can see via the ego network. So this is a random sample of users, the people that they've replied to or received replies from, and how those users talk to each other. In the programming category, those users don't talk to each other. If you ask a question and you got a bunch of help, those helpers are not going to be asking each other for help, right? They're only there to help others primarily. On the other hand, if you look at a discussion forum such as politics, a lot of these questions are not really factual. They're there to elicit opinion. And so a person who's asking a question at one moment will be someone who will be answering in another. In another, we'll get to the more broader motivations in just a sec, but we also wanted to look at what happens in a different system. So in Yahoo Answers and Java Forum, people actually contribute their time out of the kindness of their hearts. But there are some websites, for example, this site in China, TaskCN, where people will offer up money, and once they choose the best answer or the best solution to their problem, they'll actually award that money to the author of that solution. And so we wanted to know how do people respond to these monetary incentives. And what happens is that if more money is offered, more individuals will look at the task. Actually, more will also register to try and attempt the task. But actually, more of them will also give up, right? They'll determine that the task is too hard. So you have this correlation between the amount of money that someone is willing to offer to gain this answer and the difficulty of that task and also the ability of users to answer it. So if you look at users participating, right, if you remember that Java Forum visualization, you had a few individuals who were answering a lot of the questions. If you look at the TaskCN website, you have a few individuals who not only are winning most of these competitions, they're actually getting better at it over time, right? So they're increasing their chance of win at each subsequent attempt. So you might think, well, you know, they're just these core users, they're always there, they're answering everyone's question, and it wasn't until a year or two into this that we actually tried plotting the activity of these users and discovered that they weren't there all the time at all. In fact, the top users will switch out. Even the most active users will just have off weeks. And in this study, this is for the Korean website Naver, the student Kevin Nam called them up, and one of the things that he asked is, well, why were you gone there 5 weeks? And the participants would say, well, you know, I got really busy at my job, or, you know, all of a sudden I had to babysit my grandkids. And this all makes sense, right, because these are really voluntary activities, right? It's like a hobby. So we did ask specifically why they did what they did, and a lot of them did mention altruistic reasons, so they wanted to help others. A lot of them also mentioned learning, so I'm learning Java now, or I have some Java proficiency and I want to enhance my skills, or I want to keep them fresh, and that's why I go to this forum. Some of them even said that by building up a reputation on the site, it enhances their business, or they just liked earning the points, which you can't really do anything with, but it still says you've earned some great number. This was kind of interesting in that when they selected the questions, they would, yeah. The first part is actually that they wanted to answer unanswered questions. So it really bugged them that there are people out there who wanted to know something and didn't know it. And so they wanted to answer those, which might explain, going back to Java Forum, why you have the top-level experts answering complete newbie questions that are just, probably beneath or should be beneath them, right? But they still do it. Another thing we looked at was which question was typically picked as best answer, and it was usually the last, or which answer was picked as best, and it was usually the last one, meaning that people would keep answering until there was a sufficiently good answer, and then they wouldn't answer further, right? And okay, so this all tends to indicate that A, we can't stand to have unanswered questions, and we can't stand to have incorrect information in response to those questions. And this is actually good because it turns out that for big collaborative projects such as Wikipedia, the number of edits to an article strongly correlates with the quality of that article. And if you look over time, it's not just the direct edits, but actually there's more and more coordination and discussion. And this, again, is correlated to the quality of the information found on such a system. So just to summarize, the web has really enabled new ways of sharing and aggregating information. And because all of this data is readily collectible and analyzable, you can really characterize the participation patterns and the networks that form among the individuals. And then the network analysis itself can be useful not just in characterizing these patterns, but also doing tasks such as identifying the experts. So that's pretty much it.
So in research on group decision-making and problem-solving, there's this finding that if you ask a group afterwards, you know, who was most helpful, who made really good contributions as you solved this problem, that correlates quite strongly with the volume, the amount of contributions, doesn't correlate much, if at all, with the quality of the contributions as rated, you know, independently. And I think, you know, we all have a sense that in online forums and so on, there are a certain number of participants who just are high volume and maybe low utility. Yes. in their answers, and yet they're still regarded as, you know, big. They have a good reputation.
Yes.
I thought I saw some hints in some of your studies of that, a positive effect of you know, just sheer volume net of the quality or usefulness of the contribution. Is that right?
It's right. So I made a big fuss about, you know, how network analysis is really useful at discerning the experts. However, the number one predictor of whether an answer is going to be selected as best is the length of the answer. So people like the effort. They like the attention that is being paid to them. So one way that we're correcting now is for each answer provided, we see what the odds are that it was selected as best, given how many other participants there were, and so it kind of normalizes more than just this earning of points.
This comes a little bit from personal experience. Maybe other people out here on the same thing, being on some kind of a tech response site for a particular open source project. And I wonder if there's a slightly different model rather than, you know, simply the best people answer or, you know, anybody can answer. I think there's a situation where anybody above the level of the questioner can answer. You know, and so the higher the level of the question, the more it gets bumped up to a higher level. And I see, and this is anecdotal at least, but I see often that a question, you know, may be answered by someone who's not one of the top level experts on the site, but someone farther down, but they're the next up and they can try to answer it. But if they fail, then it kind of gets bumped up and there's another addition to the answer. And if that fails, then there's yet another addition to the answer till it finally gets to a level that it solves it. And like you say, then it stops. Mm-hmm. And so it's probably more of one of a limiting relationship that, you know, there's a decreasing range of experts depending on the question or the asker.
Yes. So the best preferred dynamic that we had was actually you'd only have people who are more expert, actually for both of those. What was surprising to us is that we didn't see this in the empirical forums that we were studying. I think mostly because of the poor interface.
Yeah. Well, it's not this just more. It's just that someone who's a real expert can answer any range of things. So they go to the whole range, and then some people just answer a small range.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
So I had a question over here. at the very end, you were saying that in Wikipedia, the number of edits is correlated with the quality. Mm-hmm. And I remember just hearing a talk recently by one of the developers of Citizendium, which is an alternative to Wikipedia, which is non-anonymous. You have to register. And I remember him arguing exactly the opposite, or that after a short number of edits, then the quality asymptotes. So like the articles on abortion or evolution, very controversial articles, aren't given any better quality estimates than the others. So can you say a little bit more about that data? Or
okay, so I was citing another study, so I can't, you know, really. So this was just pure. They tried to normalize for, first of all, the number for the page rank of that article. So if it was an article that gets a lot of attention, you would expect more edits. So controlling for that, if you get even more edits relative to how much attention the article is getting, I mean, maybe for a few controversial sites, that's not the case, but their overall correlation was that more edits made for a better article.
And better article meaning more more citations by other articles in Wikipedia.
No, in this case, it was whether it was selected as a featured article. So there was kind of a binary. Yeah.
Okay, the next speaker is Sinan Aral on information diffusion on social networks.
All right. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yeah.
And I need to speak into this so it's recorded, right? So my name is Sinan. What's that? I can't hear you. Oh, yeah, okay. So my name is Sinan. I'm a professor at NYU, and I have a dual appointment at MIT. I have a background in economics and sociology and econometrics mostly. But whenever somebody tries to ask me, you know, what are you, I just try to reject the question, mostly, to my peril. So today I'm going to talk about information, networks, information, and economic outcomes. And there are a lot of people involved in this research, and I won't go through any of these names, but some of you may recognize some of them. And I'm going to try to emphasize three things in particular. First, I'm going to try to focus on problematizing the theory of information diffusion by concentrating on information itself. So characteristics of information that make it different and how that it manifests in social relationships. The second thing I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on outcomes. So there's a lot of really good research about networks and network properties and how they evolve, how they dissolve, how they're born, and how they die. I'm going to sort of cheekily ask the question, so what? Okay, we have these networks, they're scale-free, sometimes they're not. How does that help us in some way? Every time I mention an economic outcome, you can replace it in your mind with a health outcome, and it's likely to also apply in different ways. In fact, I've had a lot of conversations with epidemiologists about how information is very important in sexual networks, knowing who's infected, knowing who has been tested, knowing the sexual behavior of your partners, et cetera. And the third thing I'm going to try to emphasize is identification, as econometricians like to say, or causality. So just because I observe a correlation between the hub and the node is also the most productive person in the network, does that actually mean that being the hub makes you more productive, or are you just more popular because you're the star in the organization? So I'm going to talk a little bit about strategies for identification of these questions. So here's the research program that I'm going to talk about today, and it's just one subset of my research. How does information impact outcomes of economic significance? Fairly simple question. And about information, I'm talking about its distribution amongst the population, its movement through a social group, its scarcity in one area of the network or its abundance in another, its novelty and its other characteristics. And I'm going to apply this to two settings. The first one is the productivity of information workers, and the second one is demand patterns in massive online social networks like Facebook or Yahoo or places like that. Why do I care about these two settings? I care about this one because in 1950, 36% of the U.S. labor force were classified by the BLS as information workers. Today it's more like 70%, and they contribute about 60% of the GDP of the U.S. economy. But most of our economic models of production are about making physical things like cars, widgets, steel. where the inputs are physical, the outputs are physical. We don't have a lot of good economic models about how information workers use information inputs to create information-based products and services, and so that's the point of this side. The point of that side is that Mark Zuckerberg turned down a $1 billion offer for Facebook, so somebody thinks that there's value in these social networks for peer-to-peer marketing or for the huge swaths of personally identifiable and preference information that people voluntarily post to websites like this. So on this side, I collect data. I go into organizations. I study them for several years, and I collect data like all the email logs, phone logs, IM traffic, network traffic, when people hit which databases, when. And then I mine the texts of things like email to really get into the nitty-gritty of what is being said and topic models of the information. I work with Nathan's former advisor, Sandy Pentland, on using sociometric badges to get at face-to-face interactions, what's going on at the water cooler that I can observe in email. And then I use real economic output data from accounting records and project data to fit some sort of a production function model of productivity of information workers. And I also try to focus on identification by observing natural experiments where some exogenous change changes the behavior in the network and the productivity of the workers. On this side, I use massive online interaction networks. I have a network I'm going to talk about, 27 million users of an instant messaging network and all of their purchasing patterns, things like product referral networks. And then I also have demand patterns, purchase data, adoption data of products, and things like that. And the purpose there is to study things like peer-to-peer marketing and social influence in networks. So we can ask a lot of really interesting questions with this type of data. For instance, do diverse networks actually provide access to novel information, and does that predict productivity and performance? In sociology, this is a very established thesis. Mark Granovetter and Ron Burt tell you that weak ties and connection to unconnected others should give you novel information. And then they use this to predict innovation, for instance, in some of Ron Burt's work. Other types of things are, what predicts the likelihood of receiving information in a network or receiving it sooner than somebody else? And do different types of information diffuse differently? What are the productivity effects of this? Are those productivity effects economically significant, if significant at all? On the peer-to-peer marketing side, we can ask things like, do the relational characteristics predict individual preferences better than the individual attributes? Are economic network effects, the idea that the more people adopt a product, the more valuable it is for each user, is that subject to local structural constraints? Like, the network effect of a telephone is only important to me for the people I want to call, not for all the people that I don't want to call, and things like this. So some characteristics of information that other or information exchange that other people have already touched on, I won't go through each of these, but information is very different than a lot of other things we share. So take the difference between disease and information. There's a individual choice going on there, and there's also a social choice going on there, whether you want to share information with someone. So these social choices are obviously affected by things like Dr. Rand was already talking about, reciprocity. Someone else was already talking about reputation. There's garbling, there's misinformation, there's hoarding. These types of things can actually be linked to policies that an organization might take, for instance, the incentive contracts that they offer to employees. So if your bonus is based on the performance of your team and the company versus a company where your performance is based on your own individual performance, what do you think this is going to do to the flow of information in the firm? It's probably going to have very significant effects on the flow of information in the firm. So I just want to put this list up here to say that these are highly social choices, and that there are a lot of norms and procedures and policies that can affect these social choices and how that affects diffusion. So here's just a snapshot of typical types of data I collect. This is from one firm, 500,000 phone calls, 2 million emails, 700,000 email attachments, samples of S-Flow network traffic data to understand who's hitting what databases, and then biometric card swipe data to understand who's in the same room at the same time. Calendaring data tells you when people are having face-to-face meetings. And then data on projects gives you the left-hand side of the equation, economic output. Okay? So here's some pictures, because they're obligatory. This is an organization where, you know, the nodes are connected by these dark lines or reporting relationships, and this is email communication over the management of this organization. This is face-to-face meetings from calendaring data and Outlook. This is phone communication over these same individuals. So what can we really do with this data? Well, we can measure information flows in email. Here the nodes are people, the lines are email traffic, the thickness is frequency, and it's obviously directional. And these things are characterized by some topology, and you can measure things like betweenness and constraint. And I point out constraint here because my next set of slides is going to be about problematizing this relationship between constraint and access to information. So let me just say, generally speaking, and this is a very basic definition because the actual measures are a little bit more complicated, a constrained network is one in which an individual is connected to other individuals who are highly connected to each other from an egocentric perspective. And an unconstrained one is where they're connected to individuals that are not connected to each other. And the theory goes that if I'm in this lower network, then I'm going to have my hands in a lot of different pools of information because these people are swimming in different pools of information. And therefore, I should have a lot of novel information. Okay? So with that sort of theory in mind, we can examine this information advantage argument. And the argument goes like this. Take a hypothetical network where people who are red know red stuff, people who are yellow know yellow stuff, and the yellows talk to yellows and the reds talk to reds, but they're sort of they're distributed across this network and the information doesn't sort of leak over into the other people very much. And the theory goes that the value of information in a network comes from its uneven distribution across local network neighborhoods. If everybody had all the information, it wouldn't be much value in any piece of the information in terms of arbitrage opportunities or solving problems that other people can't solve. So connections to diverse neighborhoods gives access to novel pools of information, and that novel information is valuable due to its local scarcity. And this relates back to the unconstrained network because those are the people with access to these diverse pools of information. So actors with scarce novel information, they can broker opportunities, engage in information arbitrage, use information as a commodity, apply information to problems that are intractable given local information, and that's what typically innovation scholars use this argument for. This is a 40-year-old assumption. We have a lot of evidence that the network structure is associated with performance, productivity, and innovation. So we have a lot of data that shows that people in diverse networks are more productive, more innovative, etc. And the assumption is that, well, the key here is that these diverse networks provide novel information, and that's why people are performing better. But nobody really has ever tested this piece before very explicitly. So we're going to take a look at that individually and see what we can do. But first, we're going to problematize that theory a little bit. So we do know that there might be a trade-off between network diversity and channel bandwidth, because we know that diverse networks are associated with weak ties, right? When I know a lot of people that don't know each other, it's likely my relationship to each of those people is not that strong, because if it were, those people would tend to meet each other and know each other. This is sort of the forbidden triad of Granovetter's original work. So what that means is that the more diverse your network, the more prevalence of weak ties. In each tie, the lower the bandwidth, the frequency of communication, the topical dimensions of communication, the detail of the communication, and the complexity of the communication. So the original argument is really about diversity across these channels, but you can also consider diversity flowing within each channel, that somebody that I have a relationship with might give me a lot of different topics if I have a strong relationship with them. So here's a picture of a constrained but strong relationship network and a weak tie and unconstrained network. And therefore, access to novel information might be a function of this trade-off, which itself depends on the dimensionality of the information space. How many topics are there in this space? Is it just two topics? Do I really need a diverse network to get myself information about just the two topics that I need? What about the distribution of information? Is it skewed? Is it uniform over nodes, etc.? And how fast does it refresh or change? These things then affect the degree to which this theory holds, and in different contexts, these things change. We can also say that there might be non-information resources that could be gained from a diverse network. It might not just be that I get novel information, but I could get power from that, I could get negotiating leverage from that, I could get access to capital from that. And also, there are good reasons to believe that there are diminishing marginal returns to novel information. because of bounded cognitive capacity or decision irrelevance or the fact that disparate information leads to unconnected ideas. It's sort of the flip side of complementarities of different types of ideas. So you might expect this diminishing marginal return. So how do we measure information diversity in these email networks? We use a vector space model where we characterize each email as a multidimensional vector of topic frequencies. So this vector represents topics 1 through 100, and I mention in this email topics 1, 7, and 9 this many times. And then I represent inboxes and outboxes as collections of these email vectors, and then I sort of measure their variance or spread in somebody's inbox or outbox. And in fact, I use things like cosine distance and multidimensional space to say these people are generally talking about the same things, or these people are generally talking about a bunch of diverse things. Okay. Here's a picture of, I think this is actually Jun Zhang's email inbox across three topics. We actually validate this diversity measurement using public data from Wikipedia, so we create a bunch of buckets of diverse and not diverse information. We apply these models, and we actually predict very accurately what's diverse and what's not. So what do we find? We do find, actually, that network size and network diversity predict access to diverse and novel information, so the general theory holds, but that the relationship between network size and information diversity is nonlinear. Here's the graph. The marginal increase in information diversity approaches zero after about 10 contacts. And in a closed, sort of bounded organizational network, the reason for this, and I won't show the slide, is because if I go around the room and I meet people, the chances that the marginal person I meet is non-redundant with somebody I already know are decreasing in the number of people I know. We also find that knowledge heterogeneity predicts access to diverse information until we control for network diversity. What that means is if I know people who know a lot of diverse things, that tends to matter if I'm talking to them whether I know diverse things or get diverse things from them until I control for who I communicate with and how frequently I communicate and whether the communication structure itself is diverse or not. And we also find that channel bandwidth is a strong predictor of access to diverse information. So this trade-off is important. The diversity of the information flowing in channels that are either weak or strong actually matters. Let me skip ahead a little bit. We also find diminishing marginal returns. Here's novel information on the x-axis and revenues generated on the y-axis. And you see this sort of nonlinear relationship, even controlling for the heteroscedasticity there. If I was to split this at the normalized mean, it would sort of be positive up to a point and then negative after a point. And you see that the people way out here beyond two standard deviations of access to novel information are generally much less productive than people who are like within 0 to 1 standard deviation greater than the mean. Okay? We also look at this in teams. So there's two countervailing arguments that I've heard, and I'm vastly oversimplifying here. Diversity is good because then there's more marginal contribution of each team member, and there's creativity and innovation when you have diverse ideas. And then mutual knowledge is good because it helps us coordinate, we have a common understanding, we can execute more quickly and more easily. So we drew up a simple model of this, which just essentially shows diversity and mutual knowledge being important, and then it predicts something like this, that it would be a nonlinear relationship, that up to a point, having more overlap is good, but then having too much overlap is bad, and that's generally what this model predicts. And when we take this to 1,400 executive recruiting teams, the data look like this. Those are the fitted values on the bottom and the actual data on the top, where the x-axis is normalized mutual information between team members. Okay? So the most productive teams are the ones with some sort of middle ground between having too much overlap and having too little overlap. What about information diffusion? If there's some sort of a hypothetical experiment you could go through in your head, if this is a stock brokerage and I dropped a hot stock tip on the red guy in the middle and I watched it diffuse in the network, what would predict the likelihood of receiving that stock tip? And what would predict the rate at which I receive it or how quickly I receive it? Okay. And basically what we do is we observe diffusion of keywords and phrases in email. So here's an email that was sent on 12:30 Eastern Time, 2002, from person A to these three people. And then it's time-stamped observation of the movement of keywords and phrases from individual to individual, so I can actually watch this keyword and phrase diffuse through the email. And then I can observe what are the characteristics that would predict someone actually seeing this stock tip. And this is real data. So what we did was we then sort of split this into different types of information. There's event news, which is characterized by large bursts of propagation, and then discussion topics, which has a burst and a sort of back and forth between a small number of people, like group discussion. So what predicts these two things? Are they different? Do they diffuse differently? So here are the results. First, we did it for information of all types. Men in this firm are 55% more likely to receive information of all types than women. Highly statistically significant. There's demographic dissimilarity, which reduces the likelihood. This is what Martina was talking about, the dyadic relationships that matter in predicting whether or not there's what she called an edge, but what I'm calling a transmission of information, which is an email, which, you know, when aggregated, makes an edge. Gender difference reduces the likelihood of it passing from one person to another by 13%. Education difference, 10% per year of difference in education. Age difference, 1% per year of difference in age. The strength of the tie increases the likelihood of receiving information. 10 additional emails, 2% increase. This is clearly endogenous. Path length, an additional hop if I'm two away is a 29% reduction in the likelihood of receiving. And prior project co-work, so if I've worked with this person before, I'm much more likely to receive the diffusion from them. What if I split it out into different types of information, news and discussion? Well, news travels vertically and laterally in the organization, while discussion is really traveling vertically but not laterally. This is very context specific. I don't mean to generalize this beyond this firm. This firm is organized in project teams that have hierarchical nature. They have a project manager, a consultant, and a researcher, which are at different levels of the organization. So project discussions are happening up and down. Task relationships are relevant for the diffusion of news, but task distance slows diffusion when you're talking about discussion. This is because these are about project discussions. Those are the numbers there. News travels across strong and weak ties, whereas discussion topics only travel across strong ties, people who have typically communicated a lot in the past. Men are 50% more likely to see news, but there's no gender effect on discussion. And one additional year of education difference is an 8% reduction in seeing news, and one additional year of education difference is a 17% reduction in seeing discussion. So what is the economic impact of this information diffusion? Access to information diffusion predicts individual productivity quite well. And notice I'm saying predicts, but I'm not saying causes. And I'll briefly describe to you something I'm trying to do to identify these relationships in an econometric sense. Each additional keyword seen is associated with about $70 additional revenue generated for that individual. Seeing information sooner also predicts higher productivity. An additional word seen within the first week of its emergence in the network is worth $321, whereas within the first month it's only worth $115. And access to information is much stronger predictor of productivity than traditional human capital variables like education or industry experience. What I'm trying to do to identify this relationship is exploit exogenous variation in the business cycle that is different across regions. So in other words, in New Hampshire, they'll get a burst of demand for the firm's services, but not in Arizona, and so there will be an increased demand for and access to information here for workers who are, you know, if you consider their productivity to be sort of individually fixed effect, essentially, then this will be an exogenous boost in their information sort of use, and then we can see if that's related to their productivity. I don't have the results of that yet because that data is difficult to get to. So very quickly, economic influence in massive online networks. Here I'm trying to understand to what extent do network relationships explain and influence consumers' economic choices, creating systematic population level patterns in product demand and other economic behavior. And I'm really focusing on separating selection, influence, and homophily in this analysis. I have two ongoing projects, one with a Yahoo IM network where I have 27 million users of an IM network and all their messages. Day-by-day adoption of a mobile service application launched in 2007 from its inception, Yahoo Go, which if you know is something you can download to your mobile phone, detailed demographics and geographic data, and detailed and precise data on nearly all e-commerce actions. And then I'm doing randomized experiments on Facebook where I'm showing advertisements to some people and not others and seeing the adoption of those advertisements by their friends. 6 million users on Facebook, again, detailed demographics and geographics, precise data on their personal preferences and information, control and experimental groups. So just quickly, what I did here was I first took the sample of all the people who adopted Go. That's about 500,000 people. Then I took a random sample of the entire IM network, 2%. For each of these seed populations, I then snowball sampled two nodes out from each seed node. And this will give me a relatively good two-step local network for both all the adopters and a random selection of all other IM users, be they adopters or non-adopters. And therefore, I'm trying to compare these two. In the end, the complete data is 27 million nodes, 4 billion messages, 89 million distinct relationships. And when I count all of the, I have all of their traffic on Yahoo, so I have all their page views across different types of content, which gives me a lot of information about what they are interested in, which helps me distinguish homophily from influence. 14 billion page views across all the various types of content. So here's the adoption curve. It's born. Yahoo Go goes live on the 1st of July, 2007, and those are the adopters per day. And here are the distributions of for adopters and non-adopters of the number of their neighbors or friends who are also adopters. And you see that the green line is way above the blue line, which gives initial evidence that there's clustering of economic decisions. People with friends who adopt Go also tend to adopt Go. Okay? I'll give you some more statistics. Adopters are have a five-fold higher percentage of adopters in their networks, have a five-fold higher percentage of messages from adopters than non-adopters in their networks when compared to non-adopters. They send and receive more total messages and are more connected. And in nonlinear probability and hazard rate models, both the number and percentages of adopters in one's local network are highly predictive of the propensity to adopt and how quickly you adopt from launch. The more friends you have, the less influential your friends are. Okay, so this is similar to what I think Lotta was presenting. And in a sort of comparable result, the greater average activity of one's friends, the more influential they are. But the more friends your friends have, the less influential they are on you. So if you're connected to somebody who's highly connected, they don't have time to influence you. Their influence is sort of divided amongst a lot of people. So why do I care about the difference between selection, influence, and homophily? Influence matters because if we're going to base all of our peer-to-peer marketing on the fact that I can market to someone, then they're going to market to their friends and influence them to adopt, I need to make sure that I can distinguish that from things like homophily, like the fact that, well, my friends and I tend to be friends because we have similar preferences, therefore I observe a correlation in the fact that when I adopt, my friends also adopt, but it's not because I told them about the product, it's because we have similar preferences. We have this homophily of preferences, which drives both friendship and adoption and creates this correlation between friendship and adoption. And then, of course, you have selection, which doesn't apply so much here with the adoption of Go, but might apply in terms of smoking. That, for instance, when I start to smoke, I start to take on more friends who smoke because nobody who doesn't smoke wants to hang out with me, and I have to go outside to have a cigarette, and then I run into all my new friends who are also smokers, etc. Separating these three things is very important to social network marketing. I'll skip this. It's a movie of adoption. Timing is really essential. When I play this movie, what you see is there are bursts of adoption. So people are sort of adopting in bursts, which means that there's a temporal dimension as well as a sort of friendship dimension. It gets very complicated. I'd love to talk more about it outside. And I'll end with this slide, which is, here's what I'm doing to try to separate selection, influence, and homophily. Looking at peer effects models, which are extended spatial autoregressive models, where you use different types of combinations of the size and network structure as instruments. Actor-oriented models, which I think Tom Snyders can really be credited for, which model the coevolution of networks and behavior. This is really good for separating selection from influence. Homophily, that's a different story. You might think that selection also is related to homophily, but homophily is slightly different. Dynamic match sample estimators, where I'm trying to have quasi-treatments, where those are the people with N friends who adopted before time T, and then match them with somebody who's as likely to have N friends who adopted at or before time T as the treated are, but they actually don't have those friends. So trying to control for anything that might give the propensity of the treatment of having the friend. And finally, the randomized trials on Facebook. So I'll just sort of stop there and happy to talk about it.
Can you say a little bit more about what you used as the numerator in these production and productivity studies?
Yes.
It seemed that you were looking mostly at sales.
Yes.
Sales generated.
So productivity is simply defined as, this is an old economist joke, productivity is simply defined as output over input. There are only two things in that equation which are difficult to measure, output and input. Generally, we use output over input. So in this case, what I'm using is revenue generated per person day of labor input.
The reason I ask is you're probably familiar with the literature about whether information technology contributed anything to the productivity of firms. And, of course, if what you're looking at is reported quarterly profits of publicly traded companies, the numerator is meaningless.
What do you mean?
Well, the company is trying to keep reported profit more or less steady for tax purposes. That's not the measure they're using for how well they're doing economically. And if you applied exactly the same analytical method, you would conclude that oil companies don't benefit by finding oil.
Right. Well, generally, productivity isn't measured by profit. It's generally measured by output, which can be measured in real terms or in economic terms. Real terms would be the number of cars I produce in a given unit time. Economic would be the number of cars times the price of those cars, and then the inputs would be sort of like how many people and how often they work and how much they work. But in terms of information technology, the real dilemma in that literature is it that productive firms just invest more in information technology? This is the whole endogeneity question. Or is it that that investing in information technology actually produces greater productivity? And I think that there is a general consensus now among economists that it does increase productivity. There's a few holdouts, like Robert Gordon at Northwestern. But generally speaking, there have been some good strides in that.
Certainly good.
Yeah.
And sorry for going over. Anybody wants to talk to me after, please.
I use those approaches to try to understand both the mechanisms and evolution of social behavior. So in that context, my experimental model is the honeybee, and in that context today, I sort of feel the weight of the world on me, since it's the only talk devoted to social insects. There are 20,000 species of bee alone, not counting all the ants and termites and wasps. So I'm going to try to just, in talking about my own work on honeybees, try to give you an appreciation of the value of social insects as models in the general sense of understanding social behavior and social networks. But please keep in mind that there are many great species, many really fascinating systems that we're talking about, that we could be talking about. We've heard social insects touched upon today in a couple of talks, even in a recent talk this afternoon on newbies. So they've been mentioned a few times. And as Steve said, it's a very dry audience. So let me just begin with a couple of examples from the social insect world. So aside from humans, social insects are the only animals that are known to possess these traits here, language, symbolic language, agriculture, and warfare. So we'll be talking a little bit about the language story as it's seen here with the honeybee. Ant agriculture referred to E.O. Wilson's beloved leafcutter ants, the world's oldest farmers. They not only grow a crop, they also fertilize the crop. They have weeds and they have herbicides. They don't have the GPS system, so you can't use them for some of the great stuff we heard today. And then ant warfare, there are species that actually do conduct raids on each other, tournaments, and engage in slavery and a variety of behaviors in that way. And E.O. Wilson sums this up by saying that before one waxes too poetic about social insects, if ants had the nuclear bomb, they would use it.
So just by way of orientation, I'm going to try to make two points today. First of all, I want to illustrate how useful social insects are for one particular reason, and that is that we can manipulate the social environment so precisely. We can do this out in the field in a highly replicated manner and then study the consequences of manipulating the social environment on various levels of biological organization, starting from the society itself down to the individual, then to the brain, and then the genes in the brain, in the individual, in the society, a sort of Russian dolls model that we can do out in the field, as I said, in a highly replicated and precise way. So I want to illustrate that with the first example that I'll be talking about. And then the second general point that I want to make is that models of behavior can be very useful in understanding what it is that genes do. So when we make a connection between a gene and a social behavior, that's still a eureka moment. We're still so early in this field of trying to understand the relationship between genes and social behavior that still is very exciting. But then, okay, well, we have this connection. What does it actually do? And I want to illustrate that using models of behavior can help us understand what the functions of the genes are. So I'll be making both points with item number two on the list here, and then probably rushing through the last part to just give you another indication of the role of the model. Okay, so why bees? So two features that I want to mention. First, I told you one that I'm going to come back to in a second. But first of all, bees are big enough that we can study individual behavior. We can put colored number tags on them or various forms of identification, and then study them longitudinally throughout their life. They are remarkably easy to study under those conditions. They can live in glass wall hives, and so we're able to make detailed observations of their behavior. And then secondly, as I said already, social environment can be precisely manipulated. So if you're studying a primate and you need to know what group the primate lives in, that's an experience. That takes a lot of work to find that out. They're highly mobile. There's a fission-fusion parameter that's associated with primate societies. It's difficult. With social insects, in this case honeybees, very easy. Each one of those boxes there is a society. It's a beehive. There's anywhere between 10 to 50,000 individuals. We know that. There's one queen. That's a social unit. We can, as you see in the picture, have many of these. We can control a variety of parameters. So we can make designer colonies. We can make big colonies, little colonies, genetically diverse, genetically narrow, hungry, well-fed, treat them with various neuroactive substances, with RNAi, replicate that in the field in different locations if we want to, and then, as I said, obtain the data on the effect of those social manipulations down the levels of biological organization. So a key insight that we're having in understanding the relationship of genes and social behavior is that, yes, there is the traditional relationship of genes influencing social behavior, but also we are appreciating more and more, and of course that's in the spirit of this workshop, that social information can affect behavior. But what's new is we're finding that it affects it via its effects on the genome in the nerve cells in the brain. And so then that leads to the general question of how does social information get under the skin? So we address this question with two different experimental systems in the honeybee. The first example relates to behavioral maturation. So a key trait in insect societies is a division of labor. There are individuals that do different jobs. By the way, I'm talking all about the workers. So there's a queen in an insect society. She is more or less an egg-laying machine. The queen was named during a time in human history when we were particularly enamored of royalty. If she were named now, especially by my 15-year-old son, she would be called no better than something like, yo, egg-laying mama. And the point is, there's a very important point in that, and that is that we are dealing with, as Ian alluded to, decentralized systems. No one's in charge. So the lights are on, but no one's home. The colony makes decisions. It makes a variety of different kinds of decisions, but that's based on local interactions giving rise to global patterns. So everything I'll be talking about relates to the worker bees. There are, in the honeybee colony, at the height of the season, say about 50,000 individual worker bees. They have a division of labor. It's loosely based on age. Young ones work in the hive, and then the older ones forage. And this, of course, is based on a pattern of behavioral maturation in the part at the level of the individual.
So an adult worker honeybee lives about 6 to 8 weeks. She spends the first 2.5 to 3 weeks working in the hive, activities such as nursing, taking care of the babies in the colony. Then she moves on and is involved in taking care of the substrate, building the structure of the hive, repairing it, processing food, turning nectar into honey. And then at about 2.5 to 3 weeks of age, she makes the final transition in life. She becomes a forager, and she performs that act for the rest of her life. There are a couple of features on the cartoon that you see. There's a compass. Bees learn the location where they live prior to becoming foragers. They take special flights in order to learn their address. They learn the position of landmarks. They use that in order to guide their own navigation. They also use that in order to symbolically communicate. So they learn the way the direction of the sun and the way the sun moves during the day. They then will collect either nectar or pollen, and then, as I say, they will symbolically communicate that information by means of the dance language, which is that little cartoon to the right. So here's a one-day-old adult bee emerging. Here we put a color number tag on her. Then the bee goes inside a beehive. And the phenotype of interest here for the first part is the age at onset of foraging, which is something I just described to you. So this is a very easy phenotype to study. The bees spend most of their time inside the hive, but then when they become mature enough to forage, they appear at the entrance, they take off, they disappear from view for anywhere from 20 minutes to 40 minutes. We have no idea what's going on, but they come back, they tell us what they've been doing. So there's a bee with a brightly colored load of pollen on her hind legs. It's easy for observers to see this. The bee will return, and then depending on the nature of the experiment, we either record that information, or if we're studying brain gene expression, we can collect the bee and freeze it into liquid nitrogen, that is, preserve its state of brain gene expression as it exists in the field in order to get a socially and naturally relevant readout. We a lot of times compare foragers from nurse bees. So to get nurse bees, we have to open the hive, but it's possible to do that very carefully, not disturb them very much, and get the same more or less undisturbed behavior that we can then measure from the point of view of genomics or molecular biology or neurochemistry, what have you. So with that as background, I'd like to talk a little bit about how we use the response threshold model to help understand the role of a gene called the foraging gene. It was named in the Drosophila world. We wouldn't be so presumptuous in the honeybee world because we know there are many genes involved in regulating this transition here. But that was the first one, so I'll cut them some slack. So I just want to quickly go on over the background, because the point I want to illustrate is how we use the response threshold model. So we found this gene. It's called the foraging gene. Its levels of expression in the brain are low in nurses. It increases as the bee gets older. The levels are highest in foragers. And if we treat with a pharmacological agent that causes that activates the PKG pathway, that's the particular molecular pathway that this gene is involved in, then we can cause early foraging. Okay, so the point is, we've got a gene, we know what it does at the molecular level, it's a cyclic G-dependent protein kinase, we manipulate the molecular pathway, we can cause early onset of foraging. We're thrilled. That was the first gene that we found relating to this highly complex social system. But it's a kinase. It could be doing a million and one things. How satisfying is that? So what we did was we applied the response threshold model. Here are the data, by the way, I'm breezing through. So nurses and foragers. Oh, I do want to make one important point about the ability to manipulate the social system before getting onto the response threshold model. So here we have foragers. Foragers are also older than nurses in addition to the different behavior. So a vexing problem in studying behavioral maturation is how to uncouple aging from changes in behavioral state. We can do that with social insects because we can manipulate the social environment. We can change the ways that they are perceiving their environment and the information that they're perceiving in order to uncouple age from behavior. So that's one of the tools we use is a single cohort colony. Because it turns out, even though maybe your perceptions of insects are such that, okay, you might be able to buy that they have this complex system of division of labor, but you certainly think that they're robotic, that it's very fixed. It's not the case. It's very flexible. Bees respond to changing social conditions. They can actually speed up, slow down, or even reverse their pattern of behavioral maturation. And that depends on their perception of the social environment. So if you take a colony of bees, remove all the foragers from that colony, some of the young ones speed up their maturation and become precocious foragers. It is like removing all the people older than 16 in our society, and then some 15-year-olds become drivers prematurely. So, a scary thought for me, for reasons that you already heard. So, we can simulate this. We can actually do this in a very controlled way. We take one-day-old bees, and we make so-called single-cohort colonies. So they're all one-day-old, and then when we do that, and here's a schematic of that, queen, brood, we take the workers, then we let the colony go for 7 days, and a division of labor emerges. We will have bees performing the normal job, which is nursing, but we will also have a subset of bees that are foragers. By definition, they are precocious foragers. If we allow the experiment to go on for another couple of weeks, and we do a few manipulations to prevent any of the young bees, the baby bees, from becoming nurse bees, what we will then have is an old society. So in the first case, we have a young society. If we then let the society age, we'll have an old society. Then we get some Peter Pan bees that never grow up. They act like nurse bees despite advanced chronological age. So the point is we can manipulate the social environment in order to uncouple age from behavior. And just orthogonally, I'll mention that we've identified some of the pheromones that are involved in transmitting that social information. So, for example, we identified a pheromone produced by old bees, and that is one of the main signals that the young bees use to sort of time their rate of behavioral maturation. So at the colony level, you see a reallocation of labor, some young bees doing this, some old bees doing that, and changes with these demographic changes. But we can take that down to the level of exposure to pheromone. And we have modeled this in a more formal way, but I won't go over that now. The point is to show you how we've used this to look at this gene that's upregulated in foragers versus nurses. So when we do this, we create precocious foragers, and you can see despite the age, they show the upregulation of the gene, and that's consistent with the treatment experiment that I mentioned, which is that we can take young bees, treat them, and cause them to become precocious foragers. So, okay, now back to what I started in on, which is it's a kinase. How might it be influencing the behavior? So we invoke the response threshold model. The response threshold model is a venerable model in neuroscience and behavior, and that simply is if the stimulus crosses the threshold of response, you will have an individual responding. If at the level of behavior, if a stimulus, a behaviorally provocative stimulus, is high enough, it'll cross the threshold of response, an individual will perform the task. Very simple model, and it's proven to be a very, very good model, not for all kinds of social insect behavior, but definitely for division of labor. So it's been a very useful model. So we invoked that model, and so we've taken that. We've also then taken a sort of Lego approach or module approach to the study of behavior and looked at phototaxis and asked whether there could be some involvement of this gene in a phototaxis-based model explaining it. Why? Bees live in the dark hive, and then when they get older, they get close to the entrance, and then eventually they go outside to forage where it's light. So it's very clear, and there have been some laboratory experiments to support this, that there are differences in phototaxis as the bee gets older. So this is the response threshold model. Those are most sensitive on the left, least sensitive on the right, the response threshold moving, and then you get the probability of response. So another hint that we got that suggested to us that we might follow up on this phototaxis is here's a cutaway of the bee brain to give you some perspective. When we looked at where this gene is expressed, the foraging gene is expressed in the bee brain using in situ analysis, we found that it was highly expressed in a couple of places in the bee brain. First of all, a layer of neurons in the optic lobe, and secondly, a set of neurons in an integrative region of the insect brain called the mushroom bodies. Then that region was involved in processing visual information. So you take that piece of information with the idea that as bees grow up, they do become positively phototaxis, and it seemed like a reasonable place to go. So we just simply tested bees in a simple phototaxis apparatus in the laboratory, bees that were treated with the same substance that causes an early onset of foraging. So here's the assay. So we shine a light, and then we count the number of bees that come to the light. So first of all, we were able to replicate an earlier finding that bees are positively phototactic as they get older. So on the left, you see the percent responding to the light, foragers in yellow, nurses in black, and you can see that foragers are much more positively phototactic. This is not just simply activity, because when we run the assay in the dark, as you can see, they are not more active.
So then when we treat the bees with a substance that activates the foraging gene, that's abbreviated here, cyclic GMP, you can see that it causes positive phototaxis. A pharmacological control is a very similar substance that's abbreviated here, cyclic AMP, and that did not cause the effect. It also didn't cause the early onset of foraging. So we can then link these results with the earlier ones to say that not, we haven't explained the whole story, but we can say that one way in which this molecular pathway involving the foraging gene is regulating and causing a change in behavior, causing an onset of foraging, is by causing positive phototaxis. And so we were able to achieve this by using this model, the response threshold model. Okay, then the second and final example comes from invoking the reward model. And this, it does not involve a gene, involves a neurochemical. The sort of results-oriented punchline is that cocaine makes bees dance more. Want to hear a little more about it? So some background. When bees find good food, they may dance. I stress that word. This is not a reflexive behavior. They integrate information intrinsically about the quality of the food. They also integrate information about the need of the food in the colony when they come back. They get social feedback, and then all that information goes into them deciding whether to dance or not. At any given time, you may see no more than about 50% of the bees dancing, and that 50% of the successful foragers dancing, and that's high. It may be even lower than that. That's important in appreciating these results. Dance language, as I said, is symbolic language. It symbolically communicates distance, direction, and quality of food. There's a neurochemical in the biogenic amine family, octopamine, primarily known in invertebrates, sort of acts in some ways similar to dopamine in vertebrates, in other ways to norepinephrine. Of course, many of these biogenic amines and neurochemicals have a variety of profiles, so it's kind of a sloppy analogy, but what I'm going to be talking about today is most similar for you vertebrate-oriented biologists to the roles of dopamine in reward. Octopamine levels, we found, were higher in the brains of foragers than nurses, and we wondered what it might be doing in foragers. So we knew from the insect literature that octopamine causes insects to eat more. There's a great experiment that people do with blowflies. You glue blowflies onto a stick, you treat them with octopamine, and you can put their little feet in a puddle of sugar water, and a control fly will eat and then stop. It can regulate its state of satiety. A fly treated with an octopamine agonist will eat until it explodes. Makes for a great demonstration in introductory entomology classes. So we know that octopamine affects individual feeding regulation, state of satiety in solitary context. It also affects the sucrose response threshold in honeybees in the laboratory. It makes them more willing to take lower quality food. So we were wondering whether that personal context there, that effect of octopamine on personal behavior, might also be scaled up to the society level. And in other words, I'm abbreviating that from me to we. So, in other words, if octopamine is affecting the likelihood that an individual will take lower quality food, maybe it will also affect this social behavior, this altruistic behavior, which is the likelihood of dancing, coming back to the hive and communicating given a certain quality of the food, because the probability of dancing is very much connected to the quality of the food. So we found that, yes, bees treated with octopamine will dance more, and so we were very pleased with this result, and we began to interpret it in the context of this reward model that I'm framing. The only problem is, contrary to the elegant models of reward that exist for vertebrates, the reward concept in insects is very poorly developed. There are no reward systems in an anatomical sense. There are no reward circuits. There are a few papers that suggest it, but it's just not much of a literature yet, and the concept is still sketchy. So what we really need to do to flesh this out is to go in there and do the down-home neuroanatomical work, neurochemical work, and look to see. But we thought we would take a shortcut. We thought we would take a shortcut and exploit the fact that cocaine is actually present in nature as an octopamine agonist. It's an octopamine reuptake inhibitor. And the reason why it has its effects on humans is because of the crosstalk between the dopamine transporter and the octopamine transporter. That is, it targets a comparable component of the dopamine system. So knowing that, we thought if cocaine affects dance in the honeybee the same way that octopamine does, which from the pharmacological perspective it should, this would at least give us one more piece of information allowing us to use this reward
model in interpreting the results give us some encouragement to pursue understanding dance language in a reward context. So we did the experiment. Here's the experimental setup. We looked we controlled the environment, and one downside of controlling the environment is that the dances that bees do in a small environment, this is a flight enclosure of about 20 meters long, that's good because we can control what bees come to the feeding station, the quality of the feeding station, where they go in order to standardize the experiments. But when bees find food that's only a short distance away, they do just a very simple dance, a very simple excitatory dance. They don't include the distance and direction information. And so we lose some of the quality of the experiment. Fortunately, some scientists in Australia found out that the way bees measure distance is by optic flow. And the way they found this, the way they tested this idea was they trained bees to fly through a tunnel, as you see on the right, varying the amount of optic flow. And if you train bees to fly through a tunnel where the walls show high density, they get to the end of that tunnel and they go, wow, that was a long way. And they tell you that because they report that in the dance. They show a long distance. Whereas bees from the same colony, trained in the same environment, but now the walls of the tunnel are different and they are sparser with respect to optic flow, bees get to the end of that tunnel, it's like, piece of cake, very short distance. And they dance for a short distance. So we can manipulate then distance perception in this environment so that we can get the advantages of controlling the environment while still getting a really nice readout of the dance. So when we did that, we found, as I told you a few minutes ago, cocaine makes bees dance more. So on the y-axis, we have the dance likelihood. And then on the x-axis, several different groups. We have two controls, the untreated controls. Then we have the vehicle control. Then we have our positive control, which is the octopamine treatment, abbreviated OA. And then we have a comparable dose of cocaine. And then we have on the final bar is the yellow bar there that shows treatment with cocaine and an octopamine antagonist, where you can see an attenuation of the effect, supporting the idea that we are affecting the pathway that we think we are affecting. So pursuing this cocaine work a little bit further. We've not yet been able to addict bees, but that is a goal of ours. But one thing that we have done is we have shown that we can get withdrawal in a learning assay. So when we give bees cocaine for a chronic period of time and then we withdraw that, we show a decrement in performance, which is one feature of addiction. So again, giving rise, helping to sort of flesh out the idea that we are looking at a reward-based system. And of course, the reward model has been used elegantly in studies of the vole, as we heard this morning from Steve Phelps, and they were able in that context to take these very interesting results on differences in neuroanatomical localization of a receptor and how it leads to profound changes in social system, that is monogamy or non-monogamy, and understand that in a neural context by also invoking the reward model. So in summary, social insects can be very useful for understanding various levels of social biology because of the ability to manipulate the social environment. The response threshold model has been very useful to us in understanding the role of the foraging gene in the context of behavioral maturation, and we're beginning to develop and gain confidence in a model that involves invoking the reward system to understand neuromodulation of dance language. This also has us thinking a lot about the evolution of sociality and social behavior and how one can take a physiological system like the reward system, which we know is very manipulable and labile in real time, and also see how it may be evolutionarily labile. So we have a project right now where we're generating 1 gigabase of transcriptome sequence from 12 different species of bee, brain transcriptome, to be able to do molecular evolution studies of what genes have been under selection during social evolution. And one of our targets are going to be to look at genes that may be involved in our reward system. So I'll just close by acknowledging people whose work I spoke about, Andy Barron and Yehuda Ben-Shachar. Andy on the cocaine work and Yehuda Ben-Shachar on the foraging gene work. Thank you very much.
Have you made any progress helping to deal with colony collapse disorder with this work?
We've used we created a whole genome microarray based on the recent sequencing of the genome, and so we were asked by the USDA to to look into that, and so we are. We have some interesting results related to apoptosis and decreased immune function, but the data, the subjects that we have for the study are not the right subjects. So we originally were going to do it on brain because that's what we do is brain, and then when we were told that, well, all the bees are gone and the only ones you'd have to sample would be the ones left, we don't know if those bees are sick also or if they're not sick or if they're sick because they've been abandoned because bees are obligate social animals. So we switched to gut analyses. But this is the start of the third year and there are some reports already that colony collapse disorder is starting again.
I just had a question about the timing of changing from a nursing bee to a foraging bee. On that, there's individual variation, I assume. Is that also the younger bees that are closer to the light, or do you know?
Well, there's individual variation in a variety of contexts. So, yes, there's an age component. So if you have bees that are as little as a day older, so if you make a single cohort colony that's sort of one-day-old and two-day-old bees, the two-day-old bees are much more likely to become precocious foragers. There's also a genotypic component. Certain genotypes grow up faster than others. And so, and one can separate those two in various analytical models.
I was really interested in the first part of your talk also. So, you know, in sociology, there's this idea that as individuals change, then the society structure changes, which feeds back, but there's this sort of loop. And I was wondering about, and I don't know that much about bee societies, right? So you have this gene manipulation, you get social consequences out of it, right? Now, I don't know if there's learning from generation to generation. I guess that's what I'm interested in, whether these changes affect the next generation genetically or whether they kind of revert back to the old behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so learning is involved in a variety of contexts. In this particular context, it's probably the case that there isn't learning that's involved. And you don't want to have too much of a canalized system because bees make a living on flowers. Flowers are highly ephemeral. The conditions change over time. And so the bee colony is very nimble in its ability to respond to the resources and exploit them appropriately.
A quick question. Are there any transcriptional features associated with different type of dances?
Transcriptional features? We have a microarray experiment in progress just on that. I suspect so. Based on the songbird literature, we hypothesize that immediate early genes will be involved in mediating a variety of the responses. I'll talk to you more about that.
Thank you. Our next talk is by Michael Barton on social behavior and ecology.
I want to start out by thanking Irene and the folks here at NIH, especially NIGMS, for inviting me here to this groundbreaking event. Especially, there's a lot of hard acts to follow, I think, and I'm going to talk about something that's social behavior at a very rather different spatial and temporal scale. I want to start out by saying I think the topic of this conference has a very broad implications for science and our understanding of the societies we live in. The goal, I think, ultimately is to seek to raise awareness among practicing scientists, a lot of you out there, about the potential of new research approaches and tools for studying the dynamics of humans and their interaction with the environment. And I think this can have enormous impacts on how we do science in the future. Something to note is that in social science, most of our research protocols, at least our formal research protocols, are aimed at collecting data. But we have lots of data, and that's been apparent today. I think a bigger issue for us now is what we're going to do with those data. We have protocols, but considerably fewer, that are focused on analyzing those data. And I would suggest that we have very few, if any, that are really designed for interpreting those data. To a large extent, we depend on intuition. Especially for making sense of the dynamics of complex social systems and for trying to make sense of their interaction with the environment, to actually interpret the data and the analyses that we have. As we've seen today, computational modeling is especially relevant for the latter of these, for the analysis and interpretation of dynamic human systems. And I think it's equally relevant, if not more so, for trying to look at the interactions of humans and the environment. Computational modeling also, I think, has the potential to stimulate a transformation in the practice of social science, to transform how we think about societies and their environments, how we to give us a, I guess, encourage us to characterize social dynamics in algorithmic ways, to try and make our explanations more quantitative and transparent. That's been discussed today. This is sometimes grouped under the buzz phrase of computational thinking. I think it also can stimulate a change in how we carry out our research, including hypothesis generation and testing. I think it's been apparent today, doing such things as using modeling as social experiments. And it can also change what counts for explanation, especially in terms of explaining dynamics. And finally, I think it has the opportunity to transform the role of social science in the larger domains of scholarship and society. And what I want to do today is start out with a few comments in general about coupled natural and human systems, and then show an example or a couple of examples of computational modeling for trying to understand human environmental dynamics. I think it's apparent from a lot of the talks today that human social systems are complex. As an archaeologist, and I'm an archaeologist, look at people in the past, I can say that even simple societies are complex. Hunter-gatherers in the Pleistocene are complex. However, human social complexity has been growing at an increasing rate since the beginning of urbanism around 6,000 years ago. So what we call complex societies, also called civilizations, are a lot more complex from a systems perspective than small-scale societies. We are faced today with societies with very large numbers of individuals, enormous amount of specialization and differentiation of labor that's really unmatched outside the social insects, as Gene Robinson just said, and as something of a sobering thought. Just by way of kind of getting a handle on the extent of complexity, there's about 5,400 species of mammals in the world. 350 are primates. And so this is a great deal of ecological complexity. However, in the United States alone today, there's officially recognized almost 29,000 occupational titles that are different, classified in 820 occupational groups. So within just the United States society, we see incredibly more ecological specialization and complexity than we see in all the mammals of the world. Now, when we start looking at the interaction of social systems with the natural environment, it's even more complex. It's amplified, social complexity is amplified by these interactions. Take agriculture, for example. That's something we've been doing for about the past 10,000 years. And essentially, it's a way in which humans manipulate the ecosystems of various plants and animals, control their life cycles. And now we practice this on a really massive scale. And our society is recursively impacted by the consequences of this ecological manipulation, with effects that range in scale from effects on our nutrition and ability to sustain ourselves in terms of food, but also our opportunities for encounter with animals that carry different kinds of diseases, to even the altering the nature of the deltas of the Mississippi and Nile rivers, the largest rivers in the world. So as a result, I would say that we really live in what you might call coupled socio-ecological systems, where the dynamics are not just driven by society alone, but they're driven by a combination of social practice and biophysical processes. Just a couple of examples. Recently, Peter Batusik has calculated that the nitrogen cycling in the world that's due to human activities is equal or greater than all the nitrogen cycling is due to all other processes in the world. Similarly, Wilkinson's calculated that today the amount of sediment moved as a result of human activities is greater than all the sediment moved on the surface by all other processes. Just if we look at just our domestic animals, the biomass of our domestic animals is almost double the biomass of all other wild vertebrates combined. So, you know, we'd be hard-pressed to find a truly pristine ecosystem, and humans are really a keystone species in terrestrial ecosystems today. So, you know, given that this is an enormously complex system, of course, it's characterized by effects of nonlinear relationships between cause and effect in environmental change, threshold, scale-dependent effects, emergent and unfortunately often unexpected ecological outcomes of human actions. The other thing that happens that we haven't talked about much today is that a lot of the outcomes of these enormously complex coupled socio-ecosystems, the consequences take a long time to play out because there's different kinds of time scales and cycling with social processes and biophysical processes that can amplify and dampen each other. These can take maybe centuries at times to actually play out. So as a result, I want to point out that in a large sense, environmental problems, as we think of them, really are social problems. You know, that is, environmental change has happened for billions of years without people being around. It's a problem if it affects us, and it's how we think about it. You know, even if how it's how we perceive our world. And so for that reason, it's really imperative to try and understand the dynamics of these coupled socio-ecosystems. In terms of trying to look at the way in which societies interact today with landscapes or with climate in order to make informed environmental policy, which is indeed social policy, and in order to try and forecast different kinds of risk and change in the future, you know, looking toward the future. However, modeling coupled socio-natural systems, I think, has some challenges, let's say, euphemistically, challenges for modeling. And one of which is that a lot of different kinds of the kind of processes that you encounter in socio-ecological systems really fit better with different kinds of modeling, different modeling formalisms, as my computer science colleagues would say. And the other is these long-term outcomes, long-term consequences of socio-ecological systems and their operation often makes it really difficult to try and evaluate how well models actually work with the kind of data that we have today. Like, you can't use cell phone data, at least today, to test models when you know the outcomes are not going to really play out to another century or two or three or four or five in the future. And so this gives them kind of some special problems. You know, again, for example, human land use activities, if we're thinking of humans as discrete entities or, you know, either as individuals or households or communities, you know, they're organized in nested hierarchies and following decision rules. Increasingly, agent-based modeling, individual-based modeling seems like a good way to try and represent these systems. On the other hand, surface runoff is maybe better represented by landscape cells, where the state of one cell is influenced by its neighbor cells, characterized by cellular automata, and of course stream flow may fit better with differential equations. So you've got different ways of representing the different parts of these very complex phenomena. Now fortunately we've got a number of new cyber tools, and I think that's very helpful, this gives us a chance to get new kinds of quantitative representations of these different components of social and natural systems and look at their dynamics. We've seen some of them today in agent modeling and other kinds of modeling. Ones that haven't been discussed are things like GIS, geospatial modeling. We've seen some new kinds of visualization. That all helps. But the reality is, to model these kinds of systems, very often we have to combine different kinds of models. And that's something that's just not done a whole lot, and so it poses real interesting challenges. And that's one of the things we're trying to work on in the projects I'm involved with. The other thing is that dealing with these long-term change and long-term consequences, I would suggest, as Josh Epstein did this morning, that one thing we can do is try to apply models to the past, use the past as a way to try and more rigorously evaluate models. If we can apply models to the archaeological and historic record and get them to pass through what's actually a very sparse and discontinuously spread set of points in space and time, then I think we have a better chance of creating more robust models that we can with more confidence try to apply in other situations where we can't really predict the future very well, we can't test them very well. If I want to do a land use landscape model now, I won't know whether the results are any good for another century, but if I can make it work and predict what happened in the past where we know the outcome, then that's one way to try and evaluate these kinds of models. So what I want to do here now for the rest of the talk is give a quick example of one of these kinds of projects. And this is the Mediterranean Landscape Dynamics Project. And what we're trying to do is build a modeling laboratory to look at the consequences at large scales on landscapes, the consequences of small-scale decisions of individual humans and households, and then also look at their feedbacks and do this for long periods of time at century scales. To do this, we're trying to build what we're calling a hybrid modeling laboratory that integrates agent-based modeling, cellular automata, differential equations, and we're using archaeological data both for model parameterization and as a way to try and evaluate how well the models actually work. You know, our hope in the end is to try and create fairly robust general land use landscape models that can be applied elsewhere under different conditions. Of course, this takes, not surprisingly, collaboration among many, many folks in different areas, and this is supported by National Science Foundation Biocomplexity Environment Grant. The area in which we're working spans the Mediterranean. This is an area that has some of the earliest evidence for farming in the world, so it's a good place to look at land use landscape interaction. We've got detailed study locations here in the east and in the west to try and span the range of ecological variation across the Mediterranean and the range of current and prehistoric social configurations. I got the website there if you want to take a look at it sometime, medland.asu.edu. Conceptually, the modeling laboratory that we're putting together is composed of three different kinds of models or modeling environments, and though really they kind of all work together. One is we're building a modeling environment that is driven primarily by climate change and affects vegetation, landscapes, and produces different kinds of outputs there. It's basically ecology without people. This is something that didn't happen in the real world. That's why we have to model this, but it gives us some baseline data for looking at the effects of different kinds of socio-ecological modeling that we're doing. Of course, we include real data. These are also models where we try to inferential models to understand what was going on in the past. But rather than try to infer the past from the data, which is what archaeologists normally do, we're trying to use this as a way to parameterize and evaluate, I shouldn't use validate, but more evaluate the effectiveness of the kinds of models that we do. And the one I'm going to talk about is this coupled hybrid model, socio-ecological agro-pastoral model, in which we've inserted human activity into this basic landscape model here at the top. So now landscape change is being driven by climate, by humans, affects vegetation, affects terrain, and then those feed back into human decisions as well. The coupled part uses mainly agent-based model to represent the human activity, and uses the cellular automata and differential equation modeling to represent landscape change. Then we have a series of models for parameterization that a lot of them are based on multiple regression. One's for estimating climate, and I'll talk about that in more detail later, vegetation, and some simple algebraic models for soils. So a little more on the ABM, and in all this I can talk about if anyone's interested in talking about it later. In the ABM, we're keeping it relatively simple, just looking at land use practices, leaving the rest of human society as a black box. The household is our basic unit, our agent, and those are organized into villages. Households make land use decisions based on environmental information like potential productivity, distance of the land they're going to do something with from the village, the amount of labor needed they have to invest in the land and things like this. And then they actually do stuff. They do land use activities. They can clear the land. They can cultivate. They can fallow. And, of course, they can harvest, return. They get returns from that. And the amount of returns that they get goes back into their land use decisions. But at the same time, their land use activities also changes vegetation and land surface, and this changes the landscape, which also feeds back into their land use decisions. In terms of the landscape itself, I'll throw up an equation here to show that we are using math and differential equations for those that like those things. We're using a unit stream power erosion deposition model. It's a widely used geomorphic model to estimate the amount of erosion and deposition in any given cell in a landscape. The kind of inputs to this are terrain variables like slope and aspect, hydrologic data, the amount of water flowing under different conditions, and then also the amount of rainfall that falls, intensity of rainfall, land cover, vegetation, and soil characteristics. And note here in this little flow diagram, this is where people come into this one. You know, they actually change some of these variables, mainly land cover, which feeds back into the USPED model, and it produces a map of net erosion deposition. We add that back to our terrain map, makes a new terrain, goes through it again, makes another erosion deposition map, add that back in, and so this cycles through, and we can run this for many, many cycles. The different kinds of components that go into this, obviously we have information about landscapes. We use high-resolution digital elevation models. These are terrain models from satellites or from aerial photography. And then we've actually done ground truthing on different parts of the landscape to figure out where pieces are left over from the early Holocene, and then we can kind of put them all back together and reconstruct what the landscape looked like physically in the early Holocene. So we're trying to start with that. Are estimating past vegetation that's going to parameterize this based on climate, topography, and soils, and collecting data on modern-day vegetation transects, and throw in a little bit of successional dynamics in each cell over time. And then climate, we have macrophysical climate models where we can retrodict precipitation and temperature at fairly high resolution every 400 years for the past 40,000 years. We do this at individual weather stations based on modern, starting out with modern weather data, then retrodict into the past. And then we've used a series of multiple regression models to interpolate between those weather stations to create climate landscapes. So this feeds back in. Soil, we're being very simplistic at the moment and just remantling surfaces with some amount of soil. We're starting to collect data this summer that will give us we can kind of have variable soil thicknesses. We won't talk much about that since we're not doing much yet. Anyway, this is kind of how it all fits together. So at time one, you've got climate, you've got terrain, you've got soils, vegetation, and, of course, agents, households, collect information from this. They make decisions about what they're going to do in terms of land use. They make those decisions. They perform activities, changing the vegetation. They may even change the terrain a little bit. This feeds down into our landscape model, which produces a new terrain, and climate. And, of course, then new vegetation feeds back into the agents. And so you can kind of see the recursiveness of this process. So I'll give you an example of one of these that runs. Actually, it's a fake example because it's not really running. It's just an animation of ones. This is an area, an entire watershed, a valley in eastern Spain. This is what it looks like today. It's deeply incised with various barrancos up to 30 meters deep. With little remnant surfaces that it's still farmed today. Using the terrain models we've had and geomorphic mapping, we've reconstructed what it looks like in the early Holocene without the deep incision. We've put down a couple of early farming villages where ones are known archaeologically, one here and one here. This one's on fairly steep slopes. This one's on a flat area, so different contexts. And then we've estimated what the rainfall would be at the time. It's about 5,500 BC for these. And these areas are little farming catchments. And so these are two different villages in two different locations. Let's see if I can get this going. If I'm fast enough, we'll get this one going and this one going. And what's happening here on the left, the different movement are the villages are going out and claiming and farming land, clearing it and doing different kinds of things. So they're farming it, they're getting returns, they're shifting to different areas as they get different returns for those. That's why they're kind of cycling. On the right, you can see the landscape surface results of this. Things that are in green and to blue are deposition. I'll use this. I think it shows up better. And things that are yellow to red are erosion. The redder it is, the more erosion. The bluer it is, the more deposition, the more stuff is deposited. And interestingly, the result of this is not quite what it seems. The people on the upslope here have used up all of their good land, and you think they've got the worst problems, right? And in fact, if you look over here, they're getting a lot of erosion. That's why they've used it up so quickly. There's actually a green blobbish area in here. This is deposition. So actually some of the dirt from the upstream people is benefiting the downstream people, which is interesting. However, the good fortune of the downstream people caused them to increase their population, overshoot their carrying capacity, and caused a population crash much sooner than the upstream people, whose population was severely restricted by erosion and their population was kept small. And so the upper one actually lasted longer than the lower one. So some unexpected results in this case. This was a 200-year simulation.
The upper one is the one on the lower left, not our.
Pardon me? Yeah, the down one here is the flat on the flats, and the one on the upper part is on the this way is on the slope. We've done similar kinds of experiments. Good, I'm getting close to the end. Similar kinds of experiments in Jordan, where we've looked at different kinds of farming, intensive farming versus shifting cultivation, grazing and no grazing. Large and small villages. I'm not going to show those, but I am going to show one interesting result. With one of the 200-year simulations of shifting cultivation and grazing, it produced deep incision in the Wadi Ziklab. This is a photo of the same area today that shows that same deep incision. Maybe we were lucky. We haven't rerun it again to find out if we were wrong or not, but it makes a nice picture right now. It shows that we are at least simulating the right kinds of dynamics. And another interesting result of this is that this is on vegetation, and so this is woodland vegetation. This is a little bit of open vegetation. After two generations, 40 years, you have open vegetation where people are farming, but the rest of the landscape is pretty much covered in woodland the way it was originally, not much change. But after 200 years of shifting cultivation and grazing, a large amount is covered by Mediterranean shrub vegetation, maquis or matorral, which is characteristic of the area today. So this is a long-term effect that's not apparent at two generations. It's only an effect after two centuries of this kind of activity. So it's not something that people would have noticed changing. To wrap up, I just want to say that I think computational modeling of socio-ecological systems is a critical component of what I think we're trying to build here today, which is a new science of social dynamics. But to do this, we have to be ready to think about society and ecology in somewhat new ways. We have to be able to reconceptualize societies and their environments as closely coupled complex systems rather than distinct domains and simple systems. We have to focus on dynamics of human-environmental interactions rather than static relationships and the results and just the outcomes, right? And so generalizations and outcomes isn't going to do it. We have to think about these in new ways. We also, I think, need to expand our research protocols to invest in, and by investment I mean institutional as well as individual investment in computational thinking that lets us represent human-environmental interaction and change as explicit algorithmic models. And to do this, we need to use these emerging cyber tools that a lot of people have talked about today. And I think these can help us leverage traditional methods, not replace them, but to leverage these traditional research protocols of observational data collection and confirmatory statistics. If we can do that, this gives us an opportunity to create new dimensions for interdisciplinary social and natural science and give new value to the kind of existing approaches and data we have today. I want to acknowledge all of the many different units and universities and other institutions that are contributing to this project over a very large area. And then I also want to mention real briefly another project, I'm not going to talk about it, but one that
I and a number of other people are trying to do on a pilot scale, and that's the Open Agent-Based Modeling Consortium. And this is an attempt to try and build a community of practicing researchers in social and ecological sciences to make these kind of computational tools and thinking more accessible to everybody. So it's kind of a self-help organization where we can share experiences and strategies, share models, and maybe try to promote a new science of social dynamics. And if you're interested, there's the website. Check it out. Thank you very much. It happens all the time. It's just.
So I guess I have a question about replicability or something. So let's say you find that the up mountain people lasted longer than the down mountain
right.
people. I'd still have this question of how often would that happen if you rewound the tape of history in Gould's words and reran it again. So is there ways of making replication of these results by considering lots of different cultures, or is that, I mean, would that just take too long?
So
much detailed work just to do one. How do you?
Absolutely. That's the beauty of doing the modeling. In real life, you can't rewind the tape. What happened, happened, right? But with the modeling laboratory, you can treat it as a series of experiments, you know, explore parameter space and see under what range of parameters this happens, whether it's only under a very limited set or a very common set, and then compare it against the real case studies in that area and in other areas. There are other case studies, and see, you know, which ones are more common under those circumstances. So the neat thing is that this is the only way to rewind the tape is through modeling.
Well, right. I think it's strong on the modeling side of things. I'm just interested in the validation of the model
yeah.
side of things, where it'd be nice to have more than
there are.
A couple of days. Right.
Yeah, there are a variety, though. You know, maybe not as many as we'd like, but there are actually multiple case studies that you can check these against. So that's the neat thing. Thank you.
Okay, just before our last speaker, I hope that everybody who speaks today has an opportunity to put their talks on our computer, or you can email them to me or to Monica. We'd like to have a set of the talks and possibly even make those available to people in this room, if that's okay. But I'll be in touch with you more about that. So our last talk of the day is by Robert Sussman on social behavior and evolution.
On the which?
The where it says Sussman PowerPoint.
Yeah.
In blue, where's that blue bar there? That's where it's at. That'll cut that. Over on the icon. There.
There we go. Okay. Okay, I'm going to do a broad overview of the evolution of social behavior, looking mainly at primates, and I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that Gene Robinson talked about, reward systems, and how a different view of the evolution of social behavior than the basic common paradigm might be worth looking into. Virtually all species of higher primates live in social groups, composed of kin, non-kin, and individuals of both sexes, of both sexes and all ages. The current model of primate sociality in most of the primate literature is that you get a benefit from forming groups as a response to mainly predation or infanticide. And the cost of living in social groups is basically feeding competition, and that feeding competition really drives what happens. In fact, animals are forced to live in groups, basically, in this model, and as a cost of this, they're constantly in competition. And here's a few of the sort of quotes from well-known primatologists about the importance of competition in primate social modeling. Within group competition for food and safe positions is a virtually inevitable and universal cost of group living. agonistic relationships are an especially important organizing feature in primate groups. And finally, territorial fights can be frequent and fierce. The same applies to fights inside the group. So basically, people are looking mainly as an organizing feature for primate group structure, aggression and competition. And this is based right now mainly on the sociobiological model of E.O. Wilson, even though there's some variations of this, and also on the selfish gene theory, which is essentially is based on survival of the view of survival of the of fittest in human, in evolution. In this model, basically, females compete over food because they have to raise offspring, whereas males don't have to raise offspring. They don't have offspring, so they compete over females, and that sort of drives social structure in primate groups. Also, in sociobiological theory, there's basically an underlying dominance drive, and in these theories, they assume that dominance leads to reproductive success, and there's a direct relationship between the two. Whoops. Well, this has been minimized. But basically, it reaches the popular press, and this is a book by Richard Wrangham at Harvard University, Demonic Males, and it's The Origins of Violence in Humans, Males, also, the subtitle. And a quote from this is, males who are better fighters can stop other males from mating, and they mate more successfully themselves. Better fighters tend to have more babies. This also reaches the political arena. We can see in the NIMH director in 1992 basically said, in some monkey populations, males kill other males and then, with a competition thus muted, proceed to copulate prolifically with females. So this is a general view that's often used politically for political policy. Now, what about cooperative and affiliative behavior? How is that explained in the sociobiological model? And I think this is what's really important to look at, because actually, competition is the driving force, as you'll see, even in cooperative behavior. The two basic things are kin selection, that you only are cooperative to kin because they share your genes, and therefore, in the selfish gene theory, it's a way of passing on your genes, even if it's not you living on. But if you have two offspring and they have 50% of your genes, then it's good to do it, to be cooperative or altruistic. If it's three offspring, they have 150% of your genes, so it's even more beneficial to cooperate. The other one is reciprocal altruism, where basically you will only be altruistic if you know that individual in a later date will reciprocate, so that therefore you're not really giving away your genes. There's another model also in the sociobiological literature, Franz de Waal's model of reconciliation, which has become a real fad now, everybody going out to see how reconciliation occurs in different monkey species. And that is also based on a competitive model. Individuals try to undo the social damage inflicted by aggression and actively seek contact specifically with former opponents. Or reconciliation ensures the continuation of cooperation among parties with partially conflicting interests. So again, all cooperation is basically selfish. There is no real altruism in this model. This is sort of a Thomas Hobbesian view of human evolution and social evolution, that we all live in a state of nature closely resembles civil war, a situation of universal insecurity where all have reason to fear violent death. Humans are not by social nature, but made social by contract. And this was brought up in an earlier talk, that basically you can only be cooperative if you sort of have laws that make you cooperative. Otherwise, you're not going to be cooperative. So that means that most other animals who don't have laws are going to be killing each other and basically competitive all the time. There's problems with the current paradigm, both with the data and with the theory. First, I'm going to go through some problems with the data. And this is really, I think, really interesting. We actually, a colleague of mine, a geneticist and another colleague, a primatologist, Paul Garber and Jim Cheverud, looked through 35 genera of primates, 49 species, and 78 different studies. And what we wanted to do is figure out how much time do these animals in their total day over many, many days of study actually spend in any social behavior. And then how much of that's affiliative and how much of that is actually aggressive. And when we say aggressive, this is because we're looking through the literature. What they mean by aggressive is usually any kind of aggression. If you displace another individual, they don't really usually separate mild aggression from intense aggression. So we're talking about all aggression altogether. Unfortunately, this is on my computer, it lines up, and I don't want you to really dwell on this that much anyway. But the main thing is, as you look at how much social behavior is very little, less than 5% of the time in any social behavior. And this is animals that are constantly social. So inactive social behavior is 100% of the time. They're always cohesive, they're always together. This is active social behavior. And then if we look at affiliative behavior, that's essentially most of it, with very, very little agonistic behavior at any level, including mild agonistic behavior. That was for prosimians. The silent prosimians, the ones that are active during the daytime, they do live in groups, not those that are active, they're not still groups. Yeah, I'll just stay over here. I can point at this. Well, in any case, you can see that in old world monkeys also, again, social behavior is very little. Aggressive behavior is very, very little on the right side of the screen. But there's an increase here. You can see there's some that are up to 10% rather than about 5%. And the reason for this is that in old world monkeys, we have actual grooming, which we don't have in prosimians. If we take away the grooming, the amount of social behavior is essentially the same as we find in prosimians and in new world monkeys. And the same is true of apes. Again, apes have more grooming. If you take away grooming, there's very little social behavior and very, very little agonistic behavior. We broke this down in this table, and you can see it much more readily. Prosimians, less than 4% of the behavior. New world monkeys, about 5%. Old world monkeys, up to 10%, but if you erase the grooming, it's about 4%. It's hard to erase the grooming in apes because much of the grooming is mothers and infants, which lasts for a very long time. So very little social behavior in a total day. Data on aggression are generally presented as a rate based on all occurrences of events, number of events per individual per hour. This is the aggression, and remember, this is all aggression, mild and intense. And again, if we look at these data, it's amazing how little amount of time is spent in any kind of aggression. And I can go into this in much further if anybody has any questions. So there's also a fallacy of this female feeding competition. If you look at females, again, females interacting in different types of species, we can see that there's very little time spent in any kind of conflict. You look at the one blue line there, one agonistic event every 5.2 days, up to one agonistic event every 150 days in mountain baboons, which are thought to be one of the most aggressive of the non-human primates. So it's extremely little. It has very little to do with their behavior on a day-to-day basis. Now, what about the theoretical problems? Well, one of the first ones is, if you're going to use a selfish gene model for this sort of kinship type of behavior, first of all, there's no kin recognition. No studies have been found in which primates can actually recognize their kin. And this takes a calculation to actually figure out if I'm going to actually be altruistic to one of my kin, I'd have to calculate how closely they're related in this model. And again, how do you know if somebody's going to reciprocate? There's no evidence in the literature that reciprocal altruism actually occurs. There's no good cases of this. So most cooperation is not with kin, or much of the cooperation is not with kin in primates, including humans, obviously. And there's little, if any, support for reciprocal altruism. So let's take a closer look at, first of all, human random cooperation. This is a quote from the New York Times. Minutes after the terrorist slammed jets into the World Trade Center, streams of humanity crowd the emergency stairwells heading in both directions, in two directions. While terrified employees scramble down towards the exits and survival, hundreds of New York firefighters charge upward, never to be seen again. We know that this happens in all kinds of human situations. You can even go a little further, people sending blood, sending money to victims of this event. Does this happen in other animals? We might ask, do we have these kinds of things occur in other animals? In a recent Science article by Tim Kluttenbrock, he actually summarized a lot of the data on non-kin cooperation, mutual cooperation between other animals besides primates, all basically social living animals. And he said the benefits of cooperation in animals may be more similar to those of cooperation in humans than has previously been supposed. In humans, unrelated individuals commonly assist each other, and generalized reciprocity appears to be important in maintaining many social institutions. These trends appear to have close parallels in other cooperative mammals, animals. So what are some alternative explanations for the evolution of altruistic behavior, which is one of the big problems, the big questions in Darwinian sort of theory? Cooperation is beneficial, and it has been selected for in primate evolution. So this is what I'm going to sort of set up as an alternative hypothesis, that it's actually beneficial to be cooperative, and that, therefore, it's been selected for. As I said, all diurnal primates live in social groups. And there's a great quote by Darwin, actually. He says that it has often been assumed that animals were in the first place rendered social, and that they feel, as a consequence, uncomfortable when separated from each other and comfortable whilst together. But it is more probable that these sensations were first developed in order that those animals which would profit by living in society should be induced to live together. Finally, the feelings of pleasure from society is probably an extension of the parental or filial affections, and this may be attributed in part to habit, but chiefly to natural selection. So we're getting a different idea here, that there are mechanisms that have evolved that make animals get pleasure. We were talking about that earlier, reward systems for being social. One of the things to look at is how this could occur. And one of the types of mutualism or cooperation that occurs is byproduct mutualism, which was explained very well in Doug Acton's book, Cooperation Among Animals. In byproduct mutualism, each animal must perform a necessary minimum itself that may benefit another individual as a byproduct. These are typically behaviors that a solitary individual must do regardless of the presence of others, such as hunting for food. In many species, these activities are more profitable in a group than alone. So you're actually getting a benefit, and there's no cost. There's no need also for complex calculations in this kind of situation. So you don't have to count up who your relatives are or not. You can throw that out. We don't have to worry about who are your relatives and who aren't. As such, byproduct mutualism is simple in the sense of what is needed for cooperation to evolve. If the costs of group living are less than generally thought, we need to focus on the benefits of affiliative, cooperative, reciprocal, and mutually beneficial behaviors, including benefits of social learning, to understand the evolution of primate society and other mammalian society, and also, I would say, human society. Here are some of the benefits. I'm sure we can think of others, but these are benefits of animals living in social groups: social learning, cooperative hunting, cooperative food searching, predator vigilance and protection, alliance formation, joint resource and range defense, increased reproductive activities, and providing comfort to one another, and thermoregulation, which would be partly a comforting type of situation. And what about competition? Is competition always necessary between animals sharing space or between group members? In fact, there's a recent article written by Johnson et al., in which they develop a hypothesis called the resource dispersion hypothesis. And a study of 13 group living mammalian species, only one of which was a primate, all the others are other mammalian group living species, they find, and I'm pointing to
this right here,
if resources are heterogeneous in space or time, group living might be less costly than was previously thought, regardless of whether individuals gain direct benefits from group membership. So in other words, in certain situations, it's actually beneficial to live in these groups, and there is no competition. Out of the 13 species they studied, there was no competition between individuals in 12 of those groups. Oops. So if cooperation is beneficial and competition is unnecessary, biological mechanisms should evolve to sustain and reinforce competition. That would be what you would expect to happen in these situations. So there are, as has been talked about in many of the talks before, brain and neuroendocrine systems that seem to have evolved in social living animals, including humans. In fact, the neurological pleasure areas are activated in certain prisoner dilemma type of experiments among humans. and not when they're cheating or winning, but when they're cooperating, which is quite interesting. In a recent prisoner dilemma experience, mutual cooperation has been associated with consistent activation in brain areas that have been linked with reward processing. Activation of this neural network positively reinforces cooperation. This was done by James Rilling at Emory University, and when he first did the experiment, he expected to find that these areas would be activated when there was competition and when the one or the other party won. It didn't happen that way. They got activation of these brain areas when they cooperated. So he says, we have identified a pattern of neural activation that may be involved in sustaining cooperative social relationships. What about the neurotransmitters and hormones? We've got two that we know about, oxytocin and dopamine, and I'm just going to focus on oxytocin for a minute. Oxytocin is a neuroendocrine circuitry that is associated with maternal responses in mammals, but it's also related to every type of animal bonding, parental, fraternal, sexual, and even in the capacity to soothe oneself. If you look at these bowls that we were talking that have been talked about throughout the day, there are some bowls that are social and some that are not, and those that are social have two times higher levels of oxytocin. Oxytocin is higher in females than in males. Oxytocin is released during social contact with a stranger of the opposite sex, genital stimulation, and formation of partner preferences. If you inject oxytocin in some voles that are not social, it increases their social contact in several species, it enhances partner formation, it facilitates physical contact, and inhibits aggressive behavior. Now, Susan Carter, University of Illinois at Chicago, basically says, although its primary role may have been in forging the mother-infant bond, oxytocin's ability to influence brain circuitry may have been co-opted to serve other affiliative purposes that allow the formation of alliances and partnerships, thus facilitating the evolution of cooperative behavior. So we have these mechanisms that have evolved that have really facilitated these behaviors. So I would say that neurological and hormonal mechanisms may be at the core of innate cooperative social responses. We are essentially hardwired or adapted to cooperate. The data suggests that affiliation, coordinated behavior, and proximity to conspecifics, rather than aggression, competition, and avoidance, are the major governing principles of primate sociality. To conclude, social primates appear to be adapted to cooperate and to reduce stress by seeking each other's company. Social affiliation and cooperative behaviors provide psychological, physiological, and ecological benefits to social primates that are positively reinforced by hormonal and neurological mechanisms. Ultimately, this may explain unselfish behavior, which is one thing that hasn't been explained, I think, in the literature, both in non-human primates as well as primates and other social mammals, how you can actually be completely unselfish in altruistic behavior. Basically, for most normal human and non-human primates, it feels good to cooperate. The ringtail lemur.
The one I study for. In fact, we've done specific studies on those that really interesting.
I wanted to make two comments. One, the presence of low levels of aggression would be predicted because of dominance hierarchies. So it's thought that dominance hierarchies evolve to limit aggression. So I'm not sure that one can just use the incidence of aggression to talk about the presence or absence of competition. So maybe you'd want to comment on that, and then I'll say the second thing.
I agree completely, and in fact, I think there's more to that, too, in that a lot of aggression that we see is aggression towards young or aggression towards animals that are moving away from social norms, and it's positive aggression. And in fact, it's interesting because if you study play behavior, as Mark Beckoff at the University of Colorado has done, he actually shows that play behavior is a socializing mechanism that allows animals to learn how to be social. It's really interesting.
And then the second comment is that the neuroendocrine mechanisms that you talked about at the end, I don't know if you can easily use them as evidence to support the theory. Those are proximate mechanisms, and they would be expected to evolve under any model of social evolution that's based on aggression or non-aggression. So they are a good summary of the mechanisms, but I don't know if they really support any theory, one or the other.
In fact, I agree with you on that, too. In fact, it seems like there's been some studies by a guy named Robert Cloninger on psychiatric patients, and he goes beyond this, and I won't go into that because it's pretty complex, but one of the things is that you can actually, if you're socialized wrong, you can use the same mechanisms for aggression. So it's not a hardwired thing. It really depends on socialization, and I agree. It's much more complex. Thanks for bringing that up.
I had a question on the resources.
Yeah.
The animal studies that you reviewed, were the conditions for the resources plentiful, or was there a scarcity of anything? Because you would imagine that the aggression would come out under conditions of scarcity of food, or for the males, if there was a scarcity of females, that's when you'd expect to see it. If the resources were plentiful, you might expect the more cooperative behavior.
Yes, that's true. In fact, if you put animals through bottlenecks, sometimes they become aggressive and sometimes they become lethargic. There's lots of variation in that. But it's true that these mechanisms would have to evolve during times of change. You would have more competition or less competition. In most populations, however, that have been studied, you're looking at populations in equilibrium, not going through major periods of drought or things like that. You can have a heightened amount of aggression in certain circumstances.
I have two observations or questions. One is, I'd love to see a human control group on this data about how often social animals interact. I mean, we've all been sitting here not interacting, but just kind of observing, which I assume a colony of apes might do as well. So what is the baseline? But the other point is the evolution explanations are, you know, really fascinating, powerful, and undoubtedly correct in many, many ways. But humans cooperate, they engage in warfare, they engage in competition, they do the whole range of behaviors from the most cooperative to the most aggressive, hostile, cruel behaviors. Mm-hmm. And we've evolved, you know, separate context and, you know, social conception and the way in which we construct our own realities seems to be crucial to explaining and mediating whatever we've evolved to be. And how does all this fit in? I have this feeling that, you know, there was this one thing that we're all selfish, we all compete, and that's our natural state. Now I hear you say, no, we're all naturally cooperative. I look around and I say we're naturally across the whole range, and the challenge is to understand that.
No, I agree with you completely. And in fact, what I'm bringing up here is an alternative to the idea that we're by nature violent. We're also by nature friendly. Now, the other thing, though, there is something to this, and that's the first thing is that we always think of, for example, New York City as being a violent place. But there's millions of people in New York City, and when you walk down the street, most people aren't going to beat you up, or you don't have to go through some kind of a dominance hierarchy. The thing is that, and there's a book, actually, The Human Potential for Peace, by an anthropologist called Douglas Fry, who actually has gone through the ethnological literature, both today and in the past, and found that we emphasize almost like what I call the 5 o'clock news view of human evolution, of human behavior, that we look for those things that are statistically blips. But normally, most people spend their whole life without a fist fight or without killing each other, right? So what I'm saying is we've overemphasized the aggressive part. One other aspect of this is Robert Cloninger's work again. He does work on psychiatry, and he's written a book called Feeling Good. And what he's found is most of his psychiatric patients are patients that are isolated, that have social isolation, and that the norm is to be social and to be happy when you're social. And most of his work as a psychiatrist is trying to integrate people who for some reason have been hijacked in the same systems, using the same systems they've been hijacked, and something they get pleasure from the wrong things. And it's not social. So the thing is, what's natural and what isn't? Obviously, culture and learning changes a lot of behavior, not only in us but in primates. But I hate to emphasize those 5 o'clock news things as being natural. That's sort of my real push.
That was an incredible wrap-up to the day, right back to social isolation, which is where we started. um,
So today we've had a smattering of all kinds of information, and I think I've seen some little sparks of ideas of people who want to talk to each other. Tomorrow in the morning, we're going to drill down in depth in two issues. One is the issue of how to model prejudice, and the other is the issue of modeling resilience, two concepts that have a lot of implications for our current situation. So I hope we'll see you all back tomorrow for another interesting half day. Thank you. We'll start at 8:30.